One thing I do now believe, and I think comedy has helped me, is just the idea it's going to be all right. And there's always other ideas. You know, sometimes you write a good joke and you think, oh, that's it. I can never beat that. But there's always more to come. And I think doing it and failing and getting up again and growing and seeing the steady process, there's always an ending. You've done it before. It gives you confidence that you'll be able to do it again.
皆さんこんにちは。ビジネスサクセスジャパンのポッドキャストへようこそ。 Hello everyone and welcome to the Business Success Japan podcast. This is your host, Liddy Buechelman. This podcast is made for those who want to develop or strengthen the communication skills, cultural savvy, insights into current trends and conditions, and mindsets that are essential in a Japanese business environment. The helpful practical suggestions and engaging insights offered here provide listeners with the in-depth cultural context needed to achieve their own version of success while collaborating with Japanese counterparts.Today, I have the pleasure of sharing a conversation that I had with BJ Fox. BJ is a Tokyo-based British comedian and business owner. Having first arrived in Japan in a corporate role within the video games industry, he has now written and starred in Japan's first English-language sitcom, launched Amazon Music's first original podcast, and founded Tokyo Comedy Bar, Japan's first stand-up club. Be sure to keep listening to hear more about his story and what he has to say about life, work, and creativity in Japan.
Hello, my name is BJ Fox, Benjamin Fox. Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Lydia. I am a British, Tokyo-based British comedian, business owner, and fellow podcaster.
Great. I actually started listening to your podcast during the pandemic because I was looking for bilingual content because I was a little bit lower in my Japanese ability at that point. So it was kind of a nice little companion to have while I was waiting to come back to Japan on my end.
Yeah, so the podcast, Urawaza Eigo, we've actually done about 200. Actually, strictly speaking, we've got a spin-off, so we've done over 300 episodes now. I would like to say it's one of Japan's top business English learning podcasts, Urawaza Eigo. Check it out.
So it's obviously a little bit more geared towards English learners, but it was actually super useful for me as an English speaker to kind of figure out how Japanese people think about things in a little bit of a different way, how they conceptualize things a little bit differently. So actually, it is more useful to English speakers than you might think.
Well, actually, we do live events now. We do live events every month. We're just basically a live recording at Tokyo Comedy Bar. And 10% of our audience seems to be Chinese. So we always get Chinese, and they're using it for both English and Japanese. And the concept is we explain high-level English and business mindsets in a bilingual way. Me and Ishii Terumi, who's a comedian, but she went to Tokyo University and spent some time at McKinsey as a consultant. So she's got a kind of corporate background.
Yeah, so it seems like it's something that's worthwhile for a lot of different people.
Yeah, we hope so.
Yeah, so would you mind telling me a little bit more about your history with Japan specifically? How did you end up here?
So I studied in university. I did 1 year Yugaku, 1 year study abroad in my second year of university, British university. I went to ICU for 1 year, ICU being a university in West Tokyo. Then went back to the UK, finished my course. I was studying linguistics with Japanese as well. And then I did 2 years on the JET program after that. And actually, that was not supposed to be, but I felt that was like the end of my Japanese journey. I was going back to grow up and get a job in the UK. But I ended up working in video games, firstly for a Japanese company, Pokemon, or the Pokemon company in London, when they were just setting up their office there. Then moved to a different video game company. And then when they were building up their Asia business, I first moved out to Singapore in 2010 to set up, you know, an office there. And then when that expanded and we then opened up an office in Japan in 2015. So that brought me full circle and back to Japan.
So is there any particular, other than job opportunities and perhaps your family situation now, why did you decide to stay in Japan when I feel like you could kind of go wherever you wanted to with that skill set?
This time round, do you know what? I actually only came here for a year. I actually only went to Singapore for 1 year to set up the office, and then the plan was to go home again. But that didn't happen. And this time as well, the idea was for a year. Actually, the reason I stayed this time more than anything was, so basically I do stand-up comedy on the side. Well, on the side, it's my main gig now. But just as I was like umming and ahhing about what to do next, I managed to successfully pitch a TV show to NHK World. So, you know, so I came here mid-2015. Yeah, towards the end of 2016, when I was thinking about what my next steps were going to be, this kind of loose idea of a TV show opportunity was coming up. Ended up being Home Sweet Tokyo. We did it for 4 years. So that, you know, okay, first it was like, okay, let's stick around for that. And then when I was sticking around for that, I got another job, moved from the video game world to well, basically tech, finance, visa, visa worldwide, not the Zaidu card or visa. It was the payment systems visa. So I worked for them for a couple of years. So yeah, then basically I met my wife. Now I'm here forever.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So we didn't discuss this before, but I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more what it was like to pitch a show to NHK. How does somebody even begin to do that sort of thing?
Well, that all came about because, so I used to run a lot of stand-up comedy shows in Tokyo, including what became the main one, which was a weekly show in Shimokitazawa on Wednesdays. And it just so happened that this producer turned up just to see the show, not to do anything other than see the show. And good gig, really good gig, because it was actually an international act. So I was the MC, but basically it was a professional person with years of experience. So the whole show was amazing, and I got reflected glory off of that. And afterwards, she wrote to me and said how much she loved it, how she used to grow up. She grew up in Texas, or spent some time in Texas, loved Friends, loved Full House, always was mainly making documentaries, but always wanted to pitch a sitcom. And I just then, we met for a coffee. She had an idea, and I said, actually, no, this is what I want to do. This is how I would do it. And then basically just kind of came back and said, oh, we should go and pitch this together. And then just after about, I guess, 9 months or so, you know, I was on set. Yeah, don't know how to do it, but if I knew how to do it exactly, I would try to repeat it. I don't know how to do it.
Right. No, but a lot of things somehow always just come down to going out and doing things and then networking. And then those two things come together and you can do really impressive things.
I absolutely agree with that 100%. Yeah. Like, it sounds like it kind of came from nothing, but it kind of came off like a cumulative effect of doing comedy, being there in that situation where we had an international act over that we could put on a great show for him, that we had a website that people could come and find us. And actually, one of the goals of, we do Tokyo Comedy Bar now, we run a comedy club. That's one of a loose vision or a loose goal is that if you make it, if you build it, they will come. You know, I'm 100% certain that at some point a similar wonderful opportunity, maybe not be TV, but some other kind of fun, creative opportunity will just turn up.
Right. And it's not the path that somebody would have taken if they had started out thinking, okay, my goal is to pitch a TV show to NHK. I'm going to do these things. It was quite a bit more roundabout.
Yeah. And actually, you know, the funny thing I often think about is that, you know, I meet a lot of people who do comedy full time. They go, I want to be a comedian. I'm 18 years old. I want to be a comedian. I'm going to do it. I think one of my strengths as a comedian is, you know, the maybe the breadth of experience I've had in the corporate world. And going back to the pitch, I often wonder, like, did I get that sitcom because I'm like a funny, creative person? Or is it just because I'm really good at doing PowerPoints? You know, I think it's probably, you know, a mix of both. That when it came down to it, I answered every single question they might want. This is how I, you know, in the same way, I'd like make a marketing deck or marketing strategy deck, and just seemed to work in that moment.
Yeah. A lot of times it seems like it's not about being the best at any one thing, but it's about being really good at something and then not being bad at the rest of it.
Yeah. I've tried other TV shows as well, and did that for 4 years. That was Home Sweet Tokyo. Pitched a pilot for NHK just at the end of COVID. No, it wasn't the end of COVID. We all got COVID on set. And it was like a kind of funny debate show, like more closer to stand-up comedy. We made one show of that. It was called Japanorama Rumble, where comedians, I was the MC, but comedians debating. The idea was like we were going to have like a crazy debate every single time, like what's the best noodle? And the first pilot episode, which was not picked up, was what is better for tourists, Kansai or Kantō? East or West Japan. And I think it was West Japan one.
Yeah, that must have been a really heated debate though.
yeah, it was fun. It was a good experience, yeah.
Yeah, great. So you mentioned that you have a corporate background, you also run a podcast, but how did you end up getting so interested in comedy specifically?
So I started doing comedy in Singapore. So I was in Singapore, what was it be? This was my end of my time in Singapore, so 2014-15. And I just literally, I had a girlfriend at the time and her friend did comedy. And we just went to support. And it was very much, it was an open mic. I don't even know what an open mic is, but it's like where you test new material. Anyone can go up and you know, the quality varies. You know, this wasn't the best show I've ever seen. It was like a pretty shocking introduction to stand-up comedy. And I left thinking I could do it, essentially. And going on about how I could do it. And to the point that my girlfriend at the time said, look, either do it or stop talking about it. So I did it. It was a terrible experience, really, to be honest. I did not do well. Understood it more. And then just kind of got into it. just really enjoyed it. Before that, I was actually writing science fiction comics for a British publisher, and it was slow going. I think, you know, one thing you realize with stand-up comedy, or like TV, for example, the Home Sweet Tokyo example, you know, you write a script, lots of people have input, it comes out, what, 5 months, 5-6 months later, and you realize, oh, it's nothing that I imagined it was going to be. And then you have no idea if it's funny or not, really. You know, you don't get the audience reaction, you just get a load of nasty comments on Twitter. But with stand-up comedy, the feedback looks so quick. So I think, you know, I was coming to the end where, when I was in Singapore, like writing comics wasn't going anywhere, taking a year to get something published. And then I found stand-up comedy and I was like, oh, I could think of a joke on the train, try it that night. And I found that feedback looked really good. And then I moved to Tokyo and there wasn't much opportunity to perform, but that also meant there was lots of opportunities to build your own thing. And that's how Stand Up Tokyo came about, which is the company. Well, first it was a community, now it's a company. Started doing the shows in Shimokuzawa, Roppongi, roundabout, and it just really grew and got a good community around us.
Yeah. How did you manage to start building this almost new community from the ground up? What did that look like?
Well, there was a pre-existing group doing it, and actually the main members now, like there's four owners essentially of the Tokyo Comedy Bar, Stand Up Tokyo, and two of those predate me. I'm like second generation comedian in Tokyo. It was just, we're lucky. I guess we were just lucky. There was lots of good talent, like enough talent to kind of hold a show. And then the second you start doing it, more people want to do it. Turns out every dude now, every British and American dude wants to do stand-up comedy. So actually doing a show, you know, other people start coming out, and what was like four or five friends doing a show at the beginning turned into an open mic where we're getting 10 applications. That then grew to a point that actually just Wednesday wasn't enough. So we put an open mic on a Monday as well. And just built up to, you know, fast forward to 2019 Rugby World Cup, when we were doing so many shows with lots of audience members because of all the kind of tourists coming in. And then a year later, obviously everything stopped with COVID, but now we're back. But, you know, there's lots of people want to do stand-up, and a lot of, you know, I made the joke about American and British dudes. You get, you know, lots of Japanese people want to do stand-up as well. They see it, they want to express themselves, they're interested in English learning. So we've got a really healthy community. Actually, we've got an open mic mailing list and it's got over 300 people now. And that is since last year, May, when we opened up the bar.
Wow, that's really fast. So you mentioned being able to kind of iterate material, being able to learn really quickly, but are there any other things that you feel like people can learn, or any skills that they can gain or hone further by trying stand-up?
Oh yeah, I am very passionate about doing stand-up. I kind of feel like if you've got a friend who's discovered not drinking and what he wants to convert everyone to the wonders of, you know, being teetotal, you know, or CrossFit or veganism or something. I feel the same with stand-up. I feel just the general confidence, the idea that failure's fine, the idea that everything will be all right on stage. You know, I think a lot of people are scared of public speaking. Communication skills, I think I'm a better salesperson. Again, I don't think I would have got that Home Sweet Tokyo pitch, even taking out the comedy background, had I not known the rhythms and how to get people's attention. Had I not done that stand-up, done a couple of years of stand-up beforehand. I would say everyone should give it two or three goes and just understand. I've done two wedding speeches in my life, excluding my own. I've done two best man speeches, one pre, one post stand-up. Pre-stand-up was possibly one of the worst days of my life, where the speech did not go well. And then, you know, I wanted to bury myself in a corner for the rest of the reception. Post stand-up, you know, even 1 year in, just the lessons I'd learned on how to stand up, not be afraid, not get nervous, and just talk in a compelling way. It was amazing. So yeah, I would do stand up, and I swear your life will be better.
Right. I actually have a friend right now who I think has visited a few times your club, actually, whose goal this year is to actually go ahead and try stand up. So if you're listening, go ahead and do that, please.
Can we name and shame?
He would probably not appreciate that, but I'll make sure that he listens.
That's one thing I would say. I meet a lot of people who come to open mics. So what I realize now is open mic, the audience tends to be people who, you know, deep down want to try stand up. And the one thing I would say is don't take too long, because, you know, you think you're, you know, I hear it. I'll do it when I've got the piece ready. When I've got the jokes ready, I'll do it. I'm writing now. You could write for 6 months, and I tell you, there's still 80% chance your first gig is going to go badly. So you might as well just get that first gig over and done with. Learn the lessons you're going to learn, because you can't tell, you know, writing in Starbucks, you can't tell if a joke's good or not. you have to get up there and try it. And you maybe don't understand what else is going on stage, like how to hold a mic. You know, a number of times I've seen someone have a bad first gig, spent 6 months getting ready for it, written this perfect, you know, beautiful manifesto of stand-up comedy, and they're not talking into the mic. And it doesn't go well because they're not talking into the mic. So you might as well learn how to hold a mic tomorrow and then bring your stand-up to it. So yeah, that would be my recommendation to your friend. Don't wait too long. Just get it over and done with. Or try one of the... We do workshops now. We actually do workshops. So once a month, we do a stand-up introduction to stand-up comedy workshop, which teaches the basic... Basically, kind of tries to bridge that gap between not being on stage and being on stage with a kind of easing in process.
Yeah. Obviously, we can't put all the content of that here in this podcast, but what are some tips that you'd give people who are thinking about it at the first time? How do you even get started thinking about a set or writing jokes, or where do you even start?
Actually, what I would first say is just write, as in choose, you know, one of the exercises we do is we just write either a love letter or like a something you love or something you hate about Japan. And we choose Japan is because it's like a, you know, for our audience, it's like one universal. Everyone knows Japan. And we get a very kind of diverse audience. And just write. Don't edit. Just write all the things you can think about. Don't try to be funny. Let the funny come afterwards. Just get some ideas down. And then just take a very kind of extreme stance. Don't like anything. Love it. I don't really like convenience stores. You know, hate the convenience store for that moment. In the context of a comedy club, it's fine. That's what I would say. Just write and take a very extreme stance. You know, even outsource yourself. You know, don't. You know, it's not your opinion. It's just the comedian's opinion. And just see what happens. And after you've written, I think it's a common thing, you know, write freely, edit tightly or something, you know, write first and then let the edit. If you kind of start censoring, is it funny or not? It can get difficult and you'll never get started. So I would just say, just get going. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I feel like in the brainstorming stage, you're just trying to find anything that's interesting. And then after you find something interesting, you try to make it funny.
Yeah. And also like, yeah, I think and by giving yourself a constraint as well. Like I'll make something I hate about Japan. I hate about Japan seems overly negative, but often what we would do is take the contrary stance. You know, I hate sushi. You know, obviously everyone likes sushi, or I hate the fact it's so safe in Japan. You know, taking a deliberately contrary standpoint kind of unlocks stuff. And then, you know, your brain will help out. Stuff will just come. So yeah, we actually do a funny exercise where we stand in a circle, we get the group in a circle and we just focus on one thing about the other person, like usually about their clothes, and just compliment it for 2 minutes. Just compliment, you know, Lydia, I really like your collar. And it's purple. It's the way it blends into the creases of the shirt is lovely. The white stripes remind me of a river flowing down, and just letting things come out. And then afterwards you edit. And then we flip it and we do the same circle again, but this time we diss it. We go really hard. Like, why do I hate that collar? Like, why didn't you iron it today? You know, you come here, but disrespect, you're showing me wearing an unironed shirt, and then just let it go. And that's just a way to unlock the brain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for sure.
I would say now Lydia has wearing a lovely shirt. purely for illustrative purposes.
So have you found being able to kind of take those contrary positions, being able to take different ideas to extremes, even just practicing making those observations in the first place, has been beneficial to you in either maneuvering in a different culture or more specifically building different ideas out, such as your podcast and the comedy club?
What a complex question. Okay. What a question. What one thing I do now believe, and I think comedy has helped me, is just the idea it's going to be all right. And there's always other ideas. You know, sometimes you write a good joke and you think, oh, that's it. I can never beat that. But there's always more to come. And I think like just doing it and failing and getting up again and growing and seeing the steady process, you know, with the TV show or with the podcast, you know, sometimes I'm like, I've no idea what the next episode is going to be about. But then you just get going and you start writing and stuff happens. There's always an ending. You've done it before. It gives you confidence that you'll be able to do it again. I don't know if I can extrapolate that forward to corporate stuff, but certainly, you know, going into opening Tokyo Comedy Bar, you know, fundamentally, I had no idea how to run a bar or start a business in Japan. You know, literally, I just said, okay, well, we're going to do it. And I was lucky to have people around me, a community that, you know, would support me in doing that. But yeah, just a general idea. Yeah, this is going to happen. It was a general confidence I can do stuff. I have no idea how to do it, but if I don't know, someone else will know. and it's just push forward. And if you push forward, people will come out of the woodwork and help you, was my strong belief. And so far, that has proved to be true, I would say.
Right. The term is a bias to action or something, because we think about having specific skills, obviously, and we need to practice those skills in order to get better. But doing things in the first place is also a skill, kind of having that self-drive, the courage to be able to do those things is also a skill.
Yeah. And also I feel, and this is coming from my corporate experience, I feel like if you have a big goal, people will want to support. You know, and I feel actually, even going back to comedy, like when I meet someone who's come in and they turn up and they write jokes every time, like it's interesting for us to support that or like reflect that energy back to them, as opposed to, you know, I'm not thinking of anyone in particular, but I'll do it once a month and I'm not that interested. I haven't really written anything today. I'm like, okay, well, good luck with that. You know, in the end, I think, you know, is it, I don't know, I've never heard that phrase bias to action, but you know, there's definitely a bias towards supporting people who are trying to do things. You know, you get energized by energetic people. And that, yeah, and that's certainly through comedy. And I like, you know, now I feel like within the comedy club, we're on a different level where people aren't just performing, but we've got people saying, actually, I want to do my own show. I've got a show idea. And like, yep, you want to do it? We'll support you. You know, let's do it. We got like recently started a show just for half Japanese people. And yep, that sounds like slightly exclusive. That's not the goal. It's more, you know, we got a number of half Japanese or mixed race or Kikoku Shujo performers. And they want to talk about that experience where, you know, that's interesting for them. And they can find an audience for that, which might not be, you know, last night I performed and we didn't have anyone who lived in Japan in the audience last night. Every single person was a tourist, which is wonderful, good for the business. But, you know, you're not going to do a funny joke about, you know, the difficulties of speaking Japanese and English in the same sentence to these people. They'll be like, you know, the second you say Irashima, say they've checked out. So yeah, so I feel like we're on another level now, and it's just like good creative people doing interesting stuff, and you know, people who want to do stuff, we are certainly a place that, you know, we try to support that as much as possible.
Yeah, I do think that being around creative people definitely makes you a more creative person yourself. So then people tend to have really strong opinions about Japanese comedy.
Oh yeah.
Just from my experience, would you mind sharing a little bit more about any opinions or thoughts you might have about what Japanese comedy is, even?
Okay, something comes up a lot. You know, certainly when we were starting the business, everyone was like, oh, you know, foreigners and Japanese people laugh at different stuff, which frankly, I think is not true. And also, I don't necessarily agree with the term foreigners. You know, I think, you know, American sense of humor is different from the British sense of humor, is different from different countries. Everyone's got their own slight take. And like I said before, I think the real difference is foreigners who live in Japan definitely laugh at different things to foreigners who are visiting Japan due to kind of shared experiences or different shared experiences. I've done some of the Japanese comedy, and I find the actual main difference, this is my view, it's a systemic problem, it's a system problem, in that in the UK, in the US, you can make a great living being a stand-up comedian and never being on TV. You don't have to be on TV. You know, there's some comedians who just operate in New York or just operate in Boston. There's enough clubs there that you can make a good living out just doing that scene. Same as in the UK, like people just, you know, I just perform in Manchester and Liverpool. In Japan, there is no live circuit. So the only way to make money is to get on TV. So, which meant then bottlenecks everyone doing the same sort of comedy because that's what producers like. And it's like a 2-minute sketch that will, you know, fundamentally appeal to a teenager in Okinawa and or Bar-chan in Aomori. So it's very universal, therefore becomes simplified, which is slightly the issue we face with tourists where, you know, fundamentally, if we go too deep, we lose people. You know, you want to do something based light and generic because you've got so many different viewpoints and also different levels of English even. So I think that's one problem. And it's just a case of copycat. It's just like everyone just does the same thing. I did the M1. The M1 is the big man's eye competition. I did a single person one. I just wanted to try it. And I was in the changing room. So I think you go up in like, you've got 2 minutes on stage and you're in a block of 20 people. And there were, what do you call that full body white outfit? You know what I mean? Like where it's like kind of full body. You can see your face, but it's like a leotard, but it's only full body.
Okay.
There were three people wearing that outfit in the same block. You know, but clearly they've seen someone else do that and thought, okay, that's what gets laughs. It's embarrassing enough when you're like the second person to do a joke about a Japanese toilet on the same night, but to be the third person wearing the same outfit just because that's what you think comedy is. So it just becomes this like kind of echo chamber of what everything is. You know, even like, and this is a strange example, but back in 2019, there was a show called Baddie Butter on NHK, and it's Baddie Butter, barrier-free variety. And it's a show for, essentially, it's a diversity platform. So you've got one presenter is disabled, you've got an LGBTQ presenter, various different. And they decided they wanted to expand it to the foreigner experience as well. And they you know, have foreigner stories. And they called me up, or someone called me up and said, we're doing a comedy competition. We found a video of you doing Japanese comedy on YouTube. Would you do stand-up comedy in this competition? And I just knew I was not the person for that. You know, they wouldn't like what I do. But I said, you won't like what I do, but I've got the person for you. He sings songs, funny songs. A guy called Ruben VM, he's a fellow owner of Tokyo Comedy Bar and also the producer of the Wasaego. And anyway, we go. And before we go, they say, and we had to send in the song. Yeah, and then they came back and they said, don't worry, we've rewritten your song for you. It's funny now. We've rewritten it for you. And we were like, no, that's not the way it works. And they were like, but you know, it wasn't funny before. And I was like, the reason we're doing this song is because we've done it over 100 times to Japanese audience. We know it's funny. It is a highly successful song. And they were like, no. And I just said, okay, I don't think we're the right people for it then. And this was like 2 days beforehand, by the way. So I said, okay, I think we should just leave the opportunity. And then they call back and say, oh, you can do it as it is. And it was funny. We win the competition. So he wins the competition with the song, which was a bit embarrassing because, you know, loosely speaking, no one else on that show was remotely professional. You know, it was all part-time comedians and many with disabilities. And it felt a bit wrong that we were doing a song that we'd done so many times. But it was really interesting to me that they had the audacity for a writer to be telling these people what's funny. And I assume everyone else went into that process and no one else was strong enough or confident enough or secure enough to say no. You know, turn down NHK, you know, that seems like a funny, or turn down a TV opportunity seems funny. But yeah, I feel like there's a gatekeeper system in place in Japanese comedy that is telling people what they need to do. And therefore it stops actual creativity or actual humor coming forward. But to finish this very long answer, we have a lot of Japanese comedians from big agencies performing at Tokyo Comedy Bar in English. Munemoto Daisuke, Yurianne Retriever, I don't know if you know her. She's the face of Tinder in Japan now. And she, one thing I do know is funny people are funny. You know, they're English. Certainly Yurianne Retriever's got strong English. But Munemoto Daisuke, his English is, frankly, he will never listen to this, terrible. But it's still funny. He still knows what to do, and the jokes still work, the rhythms still work. And I think the idea that Japanese comedy is fundamentally different to Western comedy is a system thing or an excuse used for people who aren't actually able to make people laugh in different languages.
Yeah, definitely. And that's very validating for me because personally, I don't like the comedy that I see on Japanese media as much. But obviously, when I have Japanese friends and we have conversations, they're hilarious.
Yeah.
And there's always just been this weird disconnect between those two things.
Can I say one final point? One thing we struggle with, I think basically in Japan, if you're a comedian, that's a choice you make when you're young and you go to a comedy school. Whereas stand-ups don't start that way. Stand-ups essentially start by, you know, going to an open mic and seeing it and wanting to join in. You know, most stand-up comedians aren't full-time comedians until they're on TV or like they've got a Netflix special, they're working on the side. Whereas I feel like in Japan, you know, I meet funny people, I'm like, you'd be great at comedy. And they're like, oh, but I'm not a comedian. I'm like, it could be. They're like, well, I'd have to go to school. I was like, you don't. You literally just need to turn up here on a Tuesday night and perform. And then you could call yourself a comedian. But this idea, like the side hustle idea, you know, doing two things doesn't always exist in Japan. You know, you've got a job, that's what I do, that's my identity. And I'm sure equally there's lots of unfunny comedians who have gone to a comedy school when they're 18 who will never make it. And yet that's their identity and that's what they're going to stick with.
What even is comedy school? I don't know if I've ever heard of that.
Oh, that's how it works. And essentially it's like a borderline kind of Ponzi scheme. Like you pay money to, or like, it's like, I don't know, it's like Scientology or something. You go in, you pay a lot of money to go to, sorry, I don't be offensive to anyone, but you pay a load of money to go in and, you know, they tell you how to tell jokes. They write your jokes for you and they give you different classes. And at the end of it, you then become a comedian. That's one of the issues we face as well, is that people can't perform on our stage because I'm only allowed to perform at clubs owned by the agency that I went to school at. And, you know, even, you know, my podcast host, we've had trouble with her agency because she went to a school. She, you know, she did a few years at a McKinsey consultant. Then she went to a comedy school and now she's a comedian for this agency. And it kind of restricts her kind of movements a little bit, despite the fact, you know, there's not actually that much opportunity. This idea that from my point of view, comedy is like a free thing. It's like the easiest form of art you can get into, just a mic stand and a corner of a pub and you can go. But no, in Japan, it's quite strict and you have to jump through these hoops.
Yeah, that's super fascinating because I had no idea that there was this whole structure behind how comedians are even made in Japan. But that does make a lot more sense than kind of how I imagined things worked here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it also makes sense why the comedy tends to become this one singular thing. If everybody's going through the same training in the first place,
yeah,
then they all learn the same method of making jokes, the same things to look for, the same ways to execute them. So yeah, it all just makes a lot more sense now.
Do you know Fua-chan? Have you ever heard of Fua-chan?
I do not.
Okay, she's a celebrity. She's a YouTuber. You would recognize her face. She's on everything. And she's got like a bright, bright colored hair with pigtails. And she's someone who essentially failed the system. She failed the comedy system, left, set up a YouTube channel, and now is the biggest comedian in Japan, one of the biggest comedians in Japan, because she just did it her own, you know, because she refused to be, I guess, pigeonholed or bottlenecked through this system. So I think it's breaking down actually a little bit. And Munemoto Daisuke, who performs with us quite a lot, he's rejected the system. Actually, he's like said, I'm not doing it anymore. I don't want to be involved in it. So he's still represented by an agency, but he doesn't do any of the TV stuff. He just built his own following, travels the country doing stand-up style shows. So I think it is changing, yeah.
Yeah, with all of the powers of social media,
yeah,
it's very hard to avoid that kind of democratization of media, and comedy is no exception. So it was really interesting to hear a little bit more about how comedy even functions in Japan. But a lot of the, well, I would assume all of the listeners of this podcast are a little bit more interested in either working in Japan, working with Japanese companies, dealing more effectively with their Japanese counterparts. So a lot of what this podcast tends to focus on is business skills. So trying to figure out how to interpret different things, how to behave properly. And I was just kind of wondering how much weight people should even put on developing those skills, in your opinion.
Well, I've listened to a number of episodes of your podcast. First, got introduced via Ben Tanaka of Retired Japan, which I listened to for personal financial reasons. And then, yeah, and I've, in preparation of this, I listened to a number of episodes as well. And yeah, I do appreciate that there seems to be a focus on, you know, respecting business culture. I think I've got strong Japanese, like Ikkyu. I took Ikkyu years ago, like back in 2005, Ikkyu level one. Do comedy in Japanese, give presentations in Japanese. My Japanese isn't that great. In some ways, it's like I don't have perfect pitch accent. I'm not 100% confident about Keigo. I make an attempt. And actually, I find that works better for me. And actually, so I've worked in the video game industry. And a lot of, certainly with the Gaishi, the foreign-based video game companies with offices in Japan, the top person will be a foreigner. Always with excellent Japanese. And again, I think it's the same traits I see in them. You know, they've got great Japanese, but they're not really too focused on the kind of slightly mysterious, slightly overwhelming or potentially scary kind of Japanese business manners. And I feel there's a whole kind of cottage industry and trying to make those things sound really difficult, you know, and therefore, you know, please use my company and I will introduce you to different companies in the correct way. And I feel like actually not kind of going for that top level of Japanese and not necessarily playing the game, or maybe being in a meeting, speaking Japanese in your own way, in the direct way, my own intonation that I'm used to in English, kind of levels the playing field a little bit. And going back to the TV show and numerous other business deals or business development works I've been involved in throughout my corporate career, actually, I sometimes think not playing the game actually helps a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder how much of that ties back to comedy, where you kind of need to understand the rules of how things work in order to be able to break those rules and make it a more effective joke, make it more engaging.
Yeah. So I would agree with that. Like, I've got a good understanding of what's going on. You know, I'm not going into a meeting and putting my feet on the table and smoking a cigar or saying, ore, ore, you know, but I'm, you know, able to manipulate it a degree. But actually, in some ways, maybe not knowing the rules is better. That's what, you know, when I got that TV show, the number of people approached me about how did I get that TV show. And one of the questions I was often asked was like, you know, what management are you in? And I was like, so I don't have a manager. They're like, that's the first step. You have to have a manager. And it was almost, I think had I known the process of getting a TV show in Japan, I would never have got a TV show in Japan, because I would have got a manager. I would have got them to pitch it. you know, I would not have had the audacity to turn up to a meeting with a pitch document ready. I'd have asked permission first, perhaps. So I do wonder sometimes, you know, not knowing the rules helps. And certainly, you know, I've certainly seen, you know, nowadays when I see young people like yourself, I'm sure, Lydia, whose Japanese is probably excellent, really striving for like pitch perfect, you know, pitch accent, almost mimicking Japanese kind of mannerisms. I do wonder how that actually plays out in the real world. Like, you know, essentially, I struggle to believe that you'll ever have strong enough, as strong a Japanese, as, you know, a fluent Japanese person, or let's say a fluent Japanese business person who will be using various, to use my phrase, urawazas or speaking techniques to kind of deliver a point or manipulate you in a negotiation. You know, by actually kind of using your own rhythm, you can kind of break it. I remember I read a book on negotiation, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. He's an FBI negotiator. And I think he gives an example of doing negotiating in Japan. And often, you know, even if Japanese business people spoke fluent English, they would still put a translator. And the sole purpose of that translator was to kind of break the flow. Because if you know, the American counterpart was speaking English and they responded in English by definition or by default, their English would not be as strong. Therefore, they would be overwhelmed in the discussion. So actually putting a translator in place, it slowed everything down. A soccer example is like Sergio Busquets for Barcelona in the middle, just breaking up the play and dictating the rhythm for their own team. That's an example no one will get. But yeah, I do wonder if you kind of, the focus is just being as natural as possible. You might not reach it. And in the end, you'll be playing the rules of someone else's game. So maybe own it a little bit more would be my advice.
Yeah, I do think that you need to think about things a little bit more meta in that sense, because yes, you can try to take on kind of this Japanese persona or what you believe a Japanese persona looks like. But then all of a sudden you're playing the same game as everybody else.
Yeah.
And you're not as good at that game. And then you are not able to do certain things because now you're just a participant in that specific game.
Yeah. One thing I would say, I've never actually worked for a Japanese company. I've always, even Visa Worldwide Japan was obviously incorporated in Japan, but fundamentally it was a gaishike. It was a West Coast based tech company when I joined. Yeah, I've always like tried to, you know, I've always been lucky, I think, but in both ways, being the good Japanese speaker in a foreign company, or you know playing by the foreign rules within in a Japanese kind of sales situation. And I think it's always benefited me to a degree.
And for a while I was teaching kind of basic Japanese business manners to mostly engineers at a specific company that did a lot of business in Japan. And a lot of them were obsessed about being perfect, about doing everything right and making sure that they didn't make any mistakes.
Yeah.
But really, I just wanted to emphasize to them that it's more like using culture as a social lubricant, like making things a little bit easier for everyone, making everybody more comfortable, making yourself easier to work with rather than trying to be perfect.
Yeah. I would 100% agree with that. I'm trying to think what the line is though, because I'm worried that I'm coming across as someone who like just walks into a meeting and just like says rule, like plays with his own rules. That's not the case, but it is just trying to like seize back some control.
Yep, definitely. So then you've obviously started and grown quite a few different projects while you were in Japan. And I was wondering if you had any advice for people who might be interested in doing that, especially if they're hoping to do something a little bit more business oriented, where there might be rules or regulations that they might not even be aware of going into it. Do you have any experiences or advice about that?
I would say starting a business in Japan is very difficult for reasons that shouldn't be there. You know, it just actually seems to be very difficult. There's lots of bureaucratic stuff that seems, from my point of view, slightly, you know, set up to fail, and taxes and expenses and stuff. That's difficult. But one thing that definitely helped me, I feel the foreign community in Japan is so helpful. Like really, and I don't know why it's a Guy Kokujin bond or something, but the number of people who help me out, and just by asking, you know, if you ask people, they will help. So that's what I would recommend. You know, when you're setting up a business, just talk to other people who are doing similar sort of things, and they will likely help you. You know, maybe they've got an ulterior motive in terms of, oh, I can help you. You know, I'm thinking my beer distributor. I want to start a club. I need beer. How would I get beer? Oh, turns out now I've got a beer distributor. It worked perfectly. But, you know, I think there's so many people who've gone through it and want to pass on the information. There's a couple of good Facebook groups as well. You know, I'm part of the Brits in Japan Facebook group. Is, you know, full of, you know, full of great knowledge, but also, and maybe it's a bit like your man, Ben Tanaka, just like someone who's done it and wants to share. And and it's super helpful. That'd be one piece of advice. Don't hold back and think you're going to have to do it yourself. There will be people who help you. Equally, you know, on the other side, there are people who will say it's not possible, it's going to be hard, or, you know, a number of people said that, like, the comedy club will fail. Just don't listen to them. I know it's terrible. Don't listen to naysayers. But, you know, fundamentally, you know, surround yourself with people who support you as opposed to people who won't. On that note, though, if you are asking to help setting up a podcast, at least watch a video on how to set up a podcast before you contact me about how do I do a podcast, okay? You know, there are some people who are like, oh, I want to do a podcast. Could you mentor me? I was like, okay, what do you know about podcasting? Nothing. Don't waste people's time. Yeah, that's what I say. Like, yeah, do it. Take yourself as far as you can go, but then, you know, reach out for help is definitely one thing. And I would also, finally, if you do it in Japan, I feel Japan is full of opportunity. It sounds weird because it's often talked about how I said it's difficult to do business here. But, you know, fundamentally, I've set up the first stand-up comedy club. I did the first English language sitcom. Sold my podcast to Amazon. You know, I did the first Amazon originals. I feel like because a lot of people aren't pre-inclined to do innovative stuff here, it does actually open up a lot of opportunities for people who are. And likewise, my wife, you know, she was like the biggest distributor of non-plastic straws in Japan for a while. You know, it was just something she did on the weekends, and just turned out no one else was doing it. And that grew and grew and grew. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in Japan. So don't be scared off.
Yeah, definitely. And can you think of any regulations off the top of your head that might tend to trip people up?
Okay, one thing that really we struggled with was setting up a bank account. Setting up a bank account is very difficult. You know, from my Western brain, you know, setting up a bank account, why would the bank ever say no? But, you know, here it's very much because I'm not asking to borrow money. I'm just asking for a place to deposit the investment. But it took a long time and it got very messy because essentially it was a case that you had to have a business running to prove that the business was successful to get a bank account. But how do you pay a builder a couple of hundred thousand dollars to build a comedy club when you haven't got a bank account where that's the money can sit in? And then in the end, you end up doing it out of your own bank account, personal, and it gets very messy when it comes to tax season. Why are you, you know, taking all this money in? So I would start early and understand that is difficult. And my advice would be PayPay Bank, one of the easier banks to work with, online banking, or just tell a little white lie about what your business does. Just set up a bank account for consulting first and then change what your company does. You know, if you go in and say you're going to start up a shop, that's your business, a shop, then the bank will want to see a shop and they won't let you in. So I feel like that was one thing I wish I'd asked someone beforehand, because it turned into a bit of a nightmare trying to get the bank account sorted. And like basically for the first 2 weeks of, you know, so 6 months into the project, when the bar opened, you know, I was taking all the money and putting into BJ Fox's personal bank account every night, which is not the way you should be doing business for tax purposes. So yeah, regulations, yeah, the finance system still has a little bit of way to go, I think, in Japan.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard about complications in other areas too related to finance. So definitely be a little bit more careful. The rules are not going to be the same as in your home country. That's
for yeah. Sure. And like this idea, like, you know, I went in with this prejudice, like opening up a bank account in the UK, anyone will give you a bank account, you know, if it's just for depositing money. But not here. No, they want to see a business plan. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any other maybe examples of communication breakdowns that you've experienced in Japan or with Japanese people that you think were possibly due to cultural differences?
Like in the end, by the way, Home Sweet Tokyo finished after season four with me being kicked off the show. Okay, just to be clear. And that was definitely cultural differences in the end. So season three, it was working with this one producer. COVID hits. She's actually moved to Singapore to be with her husband, got transferred to Singapore. So she's over there, but she was going to come back for the show, couldn't come back, COVID. So they got another producer who then brought their own director in. And that was a very difficult situation. That was, you know, basically us not being able to communicate together, you know, working with a director who didn't speak English, hadn't spent any time abroad, didn't really, you know, there's like a kind of hierarchy on set where the director is top, you know, where he kind of, it's like a showrunner position where they decide everything, which was a bit different from where we were because I wrote the script. It was my story. And it was very, very weird having done the show for 3 years. My name is Benjamin, Brian Jenkins, BJ. Essentially it's me. You know, he obviously, I was married in the show. I wasn't married at the time. A lot of my experiences, very weird being presented with scripts saying, oh, this is what you're doing this time. Oh, this is what foreigners think is funny. And basically I just rejected them outright and said, no, I'm not doing this. And it was basically, yeah. In the end, we got the show out and I took a very hard line saying, look, either I'm writing this or find someone else. And then for season five, they decided they would find someone else. Although season five in the end got canceled because of it. Yeah, but the thing is, that was cultural differences. And I played a really strong hand, like saying, look, this is how it works or not. And if you don't want to work with me, and these are my kind of, these are my non-compromising rules, then don't work with me. And being cancelled, I do often think about that. Did I take it too far? But then I don't know. It's like a creative thing. And I don't know, a creative thing, especially when it's kind of slightly autobiographical and talk about cultural differences. I felt like I don't really want someone else. I don't want a Japanese person defining the British experience in Japan or the foreign experience in Japan. So that was definitely a cultural difference. And actually, one slightly more positive, funny story. When I left Visa when season two of Home Sweet Tokyo was, well, essentially when it got renewed, and I decided I'm going to become a super famous actor. Never happened. But as I left, I got taken aside by a lot of my colleagues, and they asked me, they gave me a load of points that they wanted me to say in the exit interview, like all their kind of Gucci or their Fuman, all the things they wanted like to be told above. And I was like, well, you want me to say all this? And they were like, yeah, we can't say it. You can. You're allowed to say it. You're foreign and you're leaving. And it was quite interesting for me to think, oh, they've had all these different issues that they felt they couldn't express, but that was my role in the company. And as I was leaving, they were like, okay, here's a few free shots. Let's kind of change the way we're working with our Singapore office, and let's use Ben as he leaves. But yeah, no, it's been interesting. I definitely think that Home Sweet Tokyo is something I need to think about whether it was good. Sometimes, I don't know, sometimes you shouldn't compromise. I don't know if compromise is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, with your final example, I really appreciate that how smart they were just to figure out that this was their chance to be able to actually communicate with the people higher up and try to make some change. But with the Home Sweet Tokyo example, I think it's a really good example of how you, even if you set boundaries, even if you know what your values are, it's always a balancing act. You always kind of have to figure things out as you go, what you're willing to compromise, what sort of person you want to be in this new context, what you are willing to compromise on and what you're not willing to compromise on. It's just a very iterative process. It's not something you have to figure out ahead of time.
Yeah. And also I would say that came in season four. Like season one, you know, when I was learning, I had no experience. I very much was like at the knee of the director, learning as much as I could and really taking his lead. And the producer was there who I was, I'd grown the project with. And I think it was coming in season four where I'd actually coming in like with confidence. I can write the scripts. I know exactly who these characters are now. I know what the beats are. I know what the show is. And then for someone else external coming in and making, I was like, no, I know what I'm doing. I'm confident enough. And this is not the moment to be shrinking back. Yeah. And actually, the one thing I do regret though, with season five, I was like kind of really curious. It was funny because I got told it was cancelled actually. And then one of my friends who does comedy wrote to me and said, I'm auditioning for your show next year. I can't wait to work with you. Put a good word in with me or something. I was like, I thought it was cancelled. It turned out he was auditioning for my role. And then I found that basically what they moved to then in season five is less a foreign writer, an English native writer. It was a Japanese script. They just translated. That's what they wanted to do. And I kind of loosely knew the translator as well. So after it all collapsed, I kind of took him out for a coffee and I was like, so give me the goss, what happened? And it just seemed like the people at the top were so burnt by me, like what had happened. They were like, we don't work with foreigners anymore. I do wonder if I set back the entire movement by being too hard. And because he was like saying to them, this is crazy. You can't just translate a script and expect it to work in dialogue. You have to like get a writer in. And they were like, no. We tried a writer and turns out he was too British or something. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Thank you so much for sharing your time on the podcast. I really appreciate it. And I got a lot more new information out of it than I was even expecting. So I'm sure that my audience will appreciate it as well.
Lydia, thank you very much. I like podcasts. I like the freedom that podcasts give you. So I respect anyone who does a podcast. So thank you very much.
I hope that you enjoyed today's conversation. Be sure to check out the links in the description of this episode to learn more about BJ Fox, Tokyo Comedy Bar, and his podcast, Urawaza Eigo. If you enjoyed today's episode, go ahead and share it with a friend, colleague, or connection on LinkedIn to help spread the perspectives and information shared in the podcast. And And please remember to go ahead and leave a review or subscribe on whatever platform you're using, and also leave a rating and review if you enjoyed the podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so directly using the listener support button on Spotify for Podcasters, or contribute to my Ko-fi page, where I'm currently raising money for a new mic to hopefully improve the audio quality of future interviews. You can find the link to do so in the description of this episode. As always, I'd love to hear from you directly, so if you'd like to leave a voice message, you can find a link to do that in the description as well. But for now, remember that the more you learn, the more confident you'll become as you explore all of the opportunities Japan has to offer you. Until next time, また今度!